Hitler's War by David Irving. On the brink of a volcano. On October 15th, 1944, the day after Rommel's sudden death, Hitler's agents deposed the Hungarian regent and brought, quote, 1,000 years of Hungarian history, unquote, to an end. The coup had its origins in July, when Horthy had sent his adjutant, General Béla Miklós, to Hitler with a letter announcing his intention of appointing a military government. Hitler had received the general on July 21st and evidently made some promise about the Hungarian Jews, because 4 days later, Himmler ordered the deportations to cease. The Reichsfuhrer had already started talks with the Allied intermediaries on alternative means of disposing of the Jews, by barter in exchange for goods or foreign currency. On July 20th, Ribbentrop had advised Edmund Wiesenmayer, his representative in Budapest, that the Allies had rejected the barter proposal, as his own penciled notes reveal. At about this time, Hitler debated with Hitler the, quote, transfer of the Jews abroad, unquote, quote, setting them free against foreign currency while retaining the most important as hostages, end quote, was the proposal, to which the Reichsfuhrer added his own comment, quote, I am against it, unquote, as he subsequently checked the proposal with, checked as in check mark, with a proviso that the currency must come, quote, from abroad, unquote. Hitler evidently overruled him. The first 318 Hungarian Jews were released from Bergen-Belsen camp and transferred to Switzerland, but Himmler's intermediaries were asking for trucks in exchange, quote, to be used only on the Eastern Front, end quote. And although further consignments of Jews were allowed to leave, 1,355 in December and 1,100 in February 1945, the deal collapsed. There was no act of violence that Hitler was not prepared to commit to keep Hungary, his only remaining petroleum supplier, within his domain, his, quote, minimum economic region, unquote. From the end of August 1944, when Horthy openly courted Hitler's disapproval and announced that he had appointed General Géza Lakatos to head a military government in place of the ailing and pro-German Dom Stoje, one alarm signal after another was reported to Hitler. Initially, he fought to win time, hoping for a spectacular military victory by General Friesner to restore the Hungarian cabinet's flagging spirit. On September 7th, however, Horthy issued a semi-ultimatum demanding 5 fresh German panzer divisions within, quote-unquote, 24 hours, or he would ask the enemy's governments for an armistice. Hitler ordered Guderian to humor the demand insofar as possible, but the next morning, the 8th, the German air attaché telephoned urgent warnings from Budapest about, quote-unquote, goings-on similar to Romania. Hitler took this most seriously, since his general Kuno Heribert Fuetterer had also provided the earliest alert of the coup in Bucharest. This warning gave him 5 weeks' clear notice to stage in Hungary a counter-coup of the kind he had tried and failed to achieve in Romania in August. After Antonescu's overthrow in August, the Hungarian and German general staffs had agreed to launch an offensive from Klausenburg to capture the Romanian half of Transylvania and then to hold and fortify the general line of the Carpathian Mountains. The offensive began on the 5th, but it rapidly fell apart. The Hungarian Lakatos regime suddenly stopped the invasion of Romanian Transylvania without consulting Hitler, evidently for political reasons. This excited Hitler's immediate distrust. When General Janos Voros, Guderian's Hungarian counterpart, pleaded for more military assistance on the 12th, the Führer told him to his face, quote, I have no faith in your Lakatos government, end quote. He strongly suspected Horthy of plotting a Badoglio-type betrayal. The admiral wanted high-grade German troops moved to eastern Hungary. Then he would sign a sudden pact with Stalin and deliver these German divisions to the enemy sword. It was a real dilemma. Hitler had evidently already written off part of Hungary east of the Tisza River, but if he was not to lose western Hungary as well, he had no option but to just take the risk of treachery and pack every good division he had into the front line. Together with SS Major Otto Skorzeny, Hitler began plotting ways of eliminating Horthy's baneful influence on his generals. Immediately after Antonescu's overthrow in August, the SS commander in Budapest, SS General Otto Winckelmann, had investigated the layout and security organization of the citadel. Now, Hitler spent hours each day poring over the original building plans of the citadel and its labyrinthine underground tunnels, plotting the regent's capture and overthrow with all the Machiavellian attention to detail that had once accompanied his planning for the Dirschau Bridge and Ibn Emael fortress operations in 1939 and 1940. Hitler's overall strategy in September 1944 had derived from the comforting conviction that having digested Romania, the Red Army would wheel south to realize Russia's historic ambitions on the Dardanelles and to reach the Balkans before Britain and the United States. The Russian offensive from this very region, spilling out northward into the Hungarian lowlands, proved the falseness of Hitler's assumption. He was losing the famous Fingerspitzengefühl, the strategic instinct which had served him so well in the past. Well, he's all messed up on weird stuff in his body and explosions. On September 23rd, more alarms began quietly sounding at the Wolf's Lair. German intelligence learned that Horthy was putting out urgent feelers to the Western Allies in Italy and Switzerland, mindful of Ede Ciano's escape. Hitler ordered the Luftwaffe to keep a close watch on all Hungarian airfields to prevent Horthy from sending his family out to safety in Switzerland. He discussed with Jodl the possibility of using 3 or 4 paratroop battalions to arrest the regent. Some days later, the plan was amended to include Skorzeny and 500 Waffen-SS troops and gliders. The scale of these operations was inevitable, because Winckelmann had learned that the Hungarian commander of Budapest, General Baquet, was already plotting a large-scale military operation to round up German sympathizers. On September 25th, Hitler designated all Hungary a German quote-unquote operation zone, thus bringing it under unified general staff control to avoid the clashes of interest that had hamstrung his counter-coup in Bucharest. Ferenc Szálasi, a Hungarian right-wing leader, declared his willingness to take over the government. Millions of pamphlets were transported to Budapest in sealed police trucks ready for the coup. But these were the days in which Hitler's illness struck him down, and the coup was postponed day after day. He found out that Horthy had sent a team of negotiators to Moscow from his sickbed on October 3rd. Hitler ordered the fight for Hungary's defense to continue even though, quote, we are standing on the brink of a volcano, end quote. And there's an asterisk right there. So the terms dictated by Molotov to the Hungarian delegation on October 8, 1944, required Hungary not only to declare war on Germany, quote-unquote, immediately, but to commence hostilities against them at the same time. Just as Hitler had feared, Horthy cabled his acceptance of these terms on the 10th. Joseph Dudas, one of the delegation, directed the October 1956 anti-communist uprising in Budapest and was subsequently hanged. And back up. On the 6th, Winckelmann decided to force Horthy's hand because, as he later explained to the Reichsfuhrer, quote, you can't just keep on postponing a putsch that's all ready and waiting, end quote. He ordered 4 top Horthy men kidnapped, including General Baquet and Horthy's own son and heir. Baquet was netted at dawn on October 10th. Later that day, Himmler, Winckelmann, and SS General von dem Bock-Zelewski reported to Hitler for further orders. Bock-Zelewski was directed to take his giant 650mm mortar to Budapest and support Otto Skorzeny's operation. He arrived on the 13th. The Nazi coup would be codenamed Panzerfaust, quote-unquote bazooka. To put teeth into their political pressure on Horthy, the Russians launched an offensive on October 6th from the area between Arad and Klassenburg, across the plains toward Drebeken and Szolnok, which was on the Tisza. General Friesner's army group would indeed have been trapped in the Carpathians, but Hitler had now assembled 3 panzer divisions at Drebeken and the 10th. And on the 10th, these began a 4-day tank battle, which resulted in the destruction of several Soviet armored corps. We now know that Horthy had already crossed the political Rubicon. He had issued secret orders to the 1st and 2nd Hungarian armies to retreat. Friesner was bewildered. His operations officer wrote later, quote, "A major crisis occurred when, on October 13th, a section of the Hungarians, in fact the very ones who had been the most effusive in their friendship toward us gullible soldiers, changed to the enemy's side in mid-battle," end quote. During the following night, Hitler telegraphed the necessary instructions to Edmund Wiesenmayer, his political agent in Budapest. The next morning, October 14th, the crisis reports from Budapest multiplied. But Ambassador Rudolf Rahn had now arrived there, and so had 42 Tiger tanks, which were being conspicuously unloaded at one of the main stations. Hitler directed his regular war conference 90 minutes after midnight. It was 5 a.m. before he went to bed. The news from Budapest was that Horthy had summoned Wiesenmayer for an audience at noon. This probably meant that the hour for Hungary's defection had arrived. During the night, the Hungarian general staff telegraphed a threat to Guderian to withdraw the Hungarian troops from the front. Guderian sent his deputy, General Wenck, to Budapest with his reply, an ultimatum to the Hungarians to stop meddling with the Hungarian divisions in Friesner's army group, and to rescind within 12 hours the orders to the 1st and 2nd Hungarian armies to retreat. Even as this ultimatum was being delivered at 10 a.m., Skorzeny's team in Budapest was kidnapping Horthy's son, luring him into an ambush by telling him that an emissary from Marshal Tito was waiting for him. By the time that Hitler was awakened by his staff on October 15th, at 12:30, the die had therefore been cast. Horthy's son, rolled inside a carpet, was aboard a plane bound for Vienna. Let us hear Winckelmann's coarsely worded narrative of that day in his proud report to Himmler. Quote, "Wiesenmayer showed up at Horthy's punctually at 12 noon. Horthy immediately launched into a violent tirade, complaining that we had kidnapped his son. Wiesenmayer stood up to him like a man and didn't have to wheel out the biggest gun we had agreed on, namely to tell the old chap that if there was the least whiff of treachery, we would stand up his son against a wall. Horthy threatened to quit the war, but did not commit himself positively as to when. Shortly afterward, his radio broadcast the foul proclamation. Meantime, Ambassador Rahn had driven over to Horthy to appeal to his conscience. Horthy was crying like a little boy, clutching Rahn's hand and promising to call everything off, running to the telephone and then not speaking into it, and in general acting like somebody demented." End quote. Horthy's armistice announcement had been broadcast at 2 p.m., Almost immediately, the radio building was seized by a German police lieutenant. A new proclamation was broadcast, apparently signed by General Voros, declaring Horthy's announcement of an armistice null and void, and ordering the fight against the Red Army continued. Then came Ferenc Selassie's pronouncement that he had assumed power. Horthy and his dwindling supporters retreated into the citadel. Other Hungarian ministers, quote, "pale and evil-smelling," unquote, in SS General Winckelmann's words, sought the German protection. Thus, Horthy could hardly resist the offer put to him that evening. If he would resign and legally transfer power to Selassie, his son would be restored to him. Alternatively, at 6 a.m., the citadel would be stormed. Hitler canceled the midnight war conference and retired at 1:15 a.m. to gossip with his secretaries Gerda Christian and Krista Schroeder. Shortly before 4 a.m., Budapest telephoned. General Lakatos had told Wiesenmayer that Horthy would abdicate the next day. Horthy was asking in return for asylum in Germany for himself and his family, and for undertakings that the Reich would not blacken his name. Hitler agreed and went to bed at 4. Thus Hungary remained in his Festung Europa, such as it now was. Stalin's hopes of trapping Friesner's army group south were crushed. General Miklos, commanding the First Army, deserted to the Russians. General Lajos von Veres, commanding the Second Army, was arrested by Friesner for ordering his army to retreat. Friesner fought a second great tank battle at Drebeken and inflicted a new defeat on the Red Army. A brief respite was thus granted to Hitler in Hungary. In anticipation of the battle for East Prussia, Hitler had moved over into Bunker 11, a monstrous rebuilt complex of dormitories and offices. It would be proof against poison gas attack, since it had its own compressed air and oxygen supplies and a U-boat air conditioning plant in case all else broke down. Toward the end of October 1940, for the end of September 1944, he had ordered a realistic assessment of the Wolf's Lair defenses against mass attack. Quote, "We can't afford to take rash risks any longer. If a Schweinerei happens here, then we're all sitting ducks. Myself, my entire high command, the Reichsmarshal, the OKH, the Reichsfuhrer SS, and the Foreign Minister. What a catch we should be. If I could get my hands on the entire Russian high command at one fell swoop, I would risk two paratroop divisions for it immediately." End quote. Here on the Eastern Front, Hitler had long lost the initiative in the face of the baffling Russian superiority. An avalanche of enemy tanks had again swamped across Army Group North and reached the Baltic coast in the second week of October. Along the Memel River, the northern border of East Prussia itself, Model managed to establish a new front line on the 12th, while the long-range guns of the German battle fleet held the enemy at bay. But Schirner's attempts to drive a fresh corridor through to East Prussia failed, and the 26 divisions of his Army Group North were again cut off, this time in Courland, a 50-mile square promontory into the Baltic. In this pocket, the Army Group would remain until the war was over. A controversial appendix of Hitler's Barbarossa campaign, surviving 6 bloody battles undefeated. On October 16th, the Red Army suddenly stormed into East Prussia, evidently making for Königsberg itself. Refugee columns began streaming past Hitler's headquarters. The German divisions were outnumbered 4-1. By the 22nd, Keitel was pleading with Hitler to leave for Berlin. Martin Bormann privately instructed the stenographers to begin packing for the move to the Chancellery, gearing toward the nearby battlefield, but not Hitler. He was still far from well. Half the evening war conferences were canceled so that he could retire to bed, swooning with nameless pains against which none of the doctors could effectively prescribe. Morrell thought it was an inflammation of the nasopharyngeal area. His dentist, Professor Hugo Blaschke, x-rayed the jaw, found an agonizing defect to the second bicuspid, about which Hitler had kept silent, and was allowed to extract it. Dr. Theo Morrell gloomily wrote on October 23rd, quote, "It's real autumn here, with dense fog banks everywhere," end quote. An atmosphere of imminent defeat lay heavily in his private rooms, an air which no conditioning plant could dispel. One secretary wrote, after it was all over, quote, "It made us despair to see the one man who could end all the misery with a stroke of his pen lying apathetically in bed, gazing at us with wary eyes, while all around us all hell was loose. It was as though the flesh had suddenly realized the futility of the efforts of his will, and had just gone on strike. And Hitler, who had never run into such disobedience before, was caught unawares by it," end quote. Hitler's secretaries sat each evening gossiping at his bedside. At midnight, an adjutant would bring up the brief war report. Sometimes Colonel von Amsberg, his Wehrmacht adjutant, spent the day touring the battlefields, and then came and stood dutifully at the foot of Hitler's bed, listening to the Führer ruminating on the errors he had committed in the past. Then the miracle happened. Perhaps just because the German rifleman knew that he was still there, General Hasbach's Fourth Army halted the Russian onslaught and launched a courageous counterattack. He concentrated on the enemy spearhead west of Gumbinnen. Gumbinnen was recaptured, as Hasbach then swung south to deal with the Gold Ap spearhead, the carnage left by the Russian 11th Guards Army was witnessed for the first time. Air Force General Krepa wrote in his diary, quote, "Visited Hermann Göring Panzer Corps in the combat at Gumbinnen. In and around Nimmendorf, women and children crucified on barn doors and shot. I ordered photographs taken as evidence," end quote. The same Führer's secretary, as quoted earlier, described, quote, "Gone was his good temper. When we arrived at night for tea, he looked grim and careworn, and he had to make an effort to put these pictures and reports from the Eastern Front out of his mind. Women raped, children massacred. He swore revenge. Quote, they aren't human," unquote, he said. They're beasts of the Asiatic steppes. The war I am waging against them is a fight for the dignity of European man. No price is too high for victory," end quote. On October 25th, he told Bormann that he would definitely not leave the Wolf's Lair until the crisis in East Prussia was over. His staff nervously complied. His female secretaries asked if they ought to learn to handle pistols. Quote, "No thank you, ladies," responded Hitler loftily. "I have no desire to die at the hands of one of my secretaries." End quote. The bantering tone belied his nagging worries about his heart and vocal cords. On the 24th, he had slept only 2 hours, and Morell found him in rather low spirits. Quote, "The Führer complains that despite a treatment that has now lasted nearly 5 weeks, his voice is still not free. In his opinion, there must be another focus of these bacteria somewhere else." End quote. The doctor handed him some cardiazol ephedrine for his heart and told him to take 15 or 20 drops 3 times a day if he felt weak. Morell was also pipetting a camphor medication into both nostrils to help the blood supply to the mucous membranes. At midday on October 27th, he found his patient cranky again. Quote, "Says his voice is bad again. How can he be expected to go before the microphone and speak to the German people like this? Can't I," that is Morell, "hear from myself how rough his voice is?" End quote. Quote, "What use is increasing the blood supply to the mucous membranes," Hitler whined, "if the bacteria are not killed off? They are what matters." End quote. Quote, "It doesn't have to be bacteria that are causing the hoarseness," Morell replied suavely. "It might be the mechanical irritation that your vocal cords are permanently subjected to." End quote. At the war conference later that day, Press Chief Otto Dietrich showed Hitler an English newspaper which reported a claim by Moscow that 1,500,000 people had been liquidated in a concentration camp at Majdanek, which the Red Army had overrun near Lublin. By way of evidence, there was a photograph of neat stacks of combs. A hush fell over the war conference. Hitler angrily laid the newspaper aside. Quote, That's the quote-unquote hacked-off hands again. Pure enemy propaganda," end quote. He told Sonnleitner after the conference that Allied propaganda had claimed in 1914 that German troops marching into Belgium had cut off babies' hands and hung the children upside down in church bells as clappers. The consternation among his circle at such reports persisted. A perplexed Ribbentrop showed the newspaper to his son Rudolf, visiting him on injury leave from his Waffen-SS unit. Rudolf, too, exclaimed, quote, "Father, can't you recognize atrocity propaganda when you see it? It's the hacked-off hands again," end quote. Ribbentrop uneasily pressed Hitler in private. Quote, "It is Himmler's affair," replied the Führer dismissively, "and his alone," end quote. At midnight, on October 27th, 1944, his voice still a husky and weak, Hitler phoned Dr. Goebbels with birthday greetings. Quote, "My last weeks have been almost entirely taken up with plotting our revenge," unquote, he explained, referring to his coming offensive in the West. Colonel von Amsberg, leaving his staff to take up a frontline command, reported to him for one last time and asked the Führer what he ought to tell the officers when he joined his new unit. With a sigh of resignation, Hitler told him, quote, "You know for yourself how black things look. Tell them that my thoughts are always out there with my troops. I will keep trying to bring this war to a prosperous conclusion. But you know the way our Luftwaffe is, and there's no point in concealing it." End quote. By day and night, the most devastating rain of fire in history was eating out the heart of Hitler's Europe. A 5,000-ton deluge of bombs dropped by the British night bomber squadrons on one cowering city center within 20 minutes was now a commonplace. They came by days as well now. 9,000 tons of incendiaries and high explosives cascaded onto Duisburg on one October day. With France lost, the Luftwaffe had no early warning systems to help them. Conversely, the enemy had stationed radar guidance systems in France, enabling them to pinpoint small towns as small as Bonn despite the most adverse weather. Medical supplies, drugs, serums, bandages, anesthetics, and analgesics were scarce or even unobtainable as the factories had been destroyed. Epidemics were rampant, carried by lice and by rats burrowing through the corpse-filled crevices of the ruined cities. Synthetic rubber and oil production was hit. By October 1944, Goering had thousands of day fighters available, but now their fuel supplies were low. The refineries were blazing ruins of twisted metal. It was a vicious circle. Four times in the latter half of October, Hitler taxed Goering about the Luftwaffe. Goering told him he had now saved up 3,100 aircraft to hurl en masse against the enemy bombers, but he was waiting until the weather was good enough. To Hitler, it seemed a strategy designed to conserve only the pilots. He again began considering supplanting Goering with Grimm. On November 1st, he had another 90-minute talk with the general. Goering hurried over to the Wolf's Lair on November 3rd and again on the 5th, and talked Hitler out of it. Evidently, the price that Hitler demanded in return was that Goering must appoint General Karl Koller as Luftwaffe Chief of Staff. Goering told Koller that day about the fight being waged against him by the SS, the army, and the party. Quote, "He talked about the situation and declared that he is just fed up," wrote Koller that day. "He wished we were dead. He wished he were dead. He would like to join the paratroop army and fight with it at the front, but the Führer won't let him go, and has told him that he can only rebuild the Luftwaffe." Unquote. Be that as it may, Hitler's consultations with Goering about major Luftwaffe policy were now only pro forma. It was thanks to Hitler alone that the ME-262 was in service as a jet bomber, though 5 months later that he had, 5 months later than he had planned. As he predicted, the ME-262 was wreaking havoc against the large enemy troop assemblies around Nijmegen. General Gallant kept delaying his 3,000 fighters, Grosserschlag, the Grand Slam. Finally, Hitler lost patience. He announced at a war conference on November 6th, quote, "It's pure madness to go on turning out new aircraft all the time just so that the Luftwaffe can juggle with figures," end quote. On the 12th, Gallant claimed he had 3,700 fighter aircraft ready. On that same day, a small force of British heavy bombers attacked the crippled battleship Tirpitz at anchor in Tromsø Fjord. The Lancaster bombers, each carrying a 10-ton bomb, would have made easy targets, but the fighters arrived too late. After 8 minutes, the huge battleship capsized, entombing 1,000 young sailors in her hull. After this, Hitler did not spare Goering's feelings, least of all in public. Some days later, Goering showed him a memorandum. Hitler tossed it contemptuously aside, quote, "There's no point in my reading that. It's all a pack of lies," end quote, and he turned his back on him. To balance his grudges, Hitler showed special favor to some. Only recently he had ordered Bormann to find a suitable estate to present to Field Marshal von Manstein. He hinted to his staff that if ever Germany began great military offensives in the East, he would again send for Manstein to command. Even von Brauchitsch, whom one officer claimed to have seen riding through Berlin in full field marshal's uniform on July 20th, was restored to Hitler's favor. On August 3rd, he had written a letter dissociating himself from the Putschists, and now that Hitler's secret order creating the Volkssturm, the People's Army, under Himmler, had been made public, the elderly field marshal wrote again, offering his life for Germany. Brauchitsch was given high marks in Hitler's book for having fostered Peenemünde and the V-2 rocket project. Only the V-2 rocket could still reach London. 20 or 30 times a day the missiles were hitting the British capital. A terrifying weapon of destruction, each colossal blast followed a minute later by the supersonic double bang of the missile's arrival. Quote, "No population can hold out under such an uninterrupted bombardment," unquote, Hitler gloated to his secretaries. Quote, "Their nerves won't stand it, because there is no warning from the sirens. Sheer panic will grip the masses and drive them out into the open countryside. But just imagine what that means for millions of people to swarm out to where there is neither roof nor rafter to accommodate them. It will be an avalanche of misery and suffering, because even when the people get there, the local villagers will regard them as a plague. What parliamentary government can survive that?" End quote. Ever since his 2-week jaundice illness, his interest in domestic affairs had been only perfunctory. He had concerned himself almost exclusively with military command decisions. On September 24th, 1944, he had signed his last law into the statute book, a minor item permitting Wehrmacht members to belong to the Nazi party. He now became Hitler, the warlord, pure and simple. In the East and West, in the Balkans, in Italy, and in Norway, he was having to yield ground to the enemy, which he might have been able to defend with his newly forming strategic reserves, but for his unshakable decision to concentrate those reserves in a great winter counteroffensive in the Ardennes. Each day was, for Hitler personally, a battle. his physique damaged by the July 20th bomb and the illness, he could barely muster the strength to hold his evening war conference. After supper on October 29th, for example, he received Fagelein, Puttgammer, and Sonnleitner in his bunker bedroom to hear their reports on SS, Wehrmacht, and foreign affairs. Then he sat sipping tea until 3:30 a.m., but he could not sleep. Dr. Morell was fetched at 6:10 a.m., no doubt with sedatives, and again after a quote-unquote breakfast 8 hours later. Morell's glucose and vitamin-laden hypodermic syringes were getting on Hitler's nerves. For his part, the professor noticed that because of Hitler's squatting for months on end in his bunker without natural light or fresh air, his blood lacked oxygen. Morell's needles often left painful and raw patches on Hitler's arms. On the first day of November, Hitler remarked irritably, quote, "Perhaps it is the injections themselves that are allowing bacteria into my body," end quote. The next day, the military news being better, Morell was not sent for. On the third, he recorded, quote, "Hitler slept well, 6 or 7 hours. 6 or 7 hours, though with sedatives. Complains a lot about the tremor in his left leg and hands. However, the latter, when extended with fingers spread, showed no visible tremor," end quote. End quotes. When the 20th of July happened, Hitler told him, all this shaking suddenly stopped, but now it's crept back again, and it's worse than ever, end quote. Morell attributed it to the constant burdens and upsets. Quote, "What is to be done against it?" asked Hitler. Quote, "Peace and quiet, and keep out of trouble," replied the doctor, adding in his diary the observation, "These things are all impossible," end quote. Hitler's big Ardennes gamble would depend on the Eastern Front remaining stable. General Guderian predicted that Stalin would delay his main offensive until the frost. Thwarted in East Prussia by Hausbach's counterattack, the Red Army had stormed Schirner's army group in Courland on October 27th. Again, the enemy lost heavily. On the 11th day, General Wenck said triumphantly, quote, "We have already knocked out 522 tanks," unquote. When Hitler soberly pointed out that the Russians had, quote, "huge numbers of tanks," unquote, Wenck continued, quote, "against which our own material losses are only 3 75mm guns, 7 light field howitzers, 9 122mm Russian guns, and 1 150mm, end quote. Quote, "Slight losses indeed," conceded Hitler. "When we stand fast, all our losses have come from our glorious retreats, the kind of retreat one makes to regain one's tactical freedom," end quote. By November 5th, the Red Army had also been thrown out of the East Prussian town of Goldap. Quote, "They are staking everything on their artillery," Hitler pronounced. "Their divisions are all under strength, just conglomerations of a few thousand men," unquote. Wenck agreed. Hitler tried to read Stalin's mind. Where would it be best to launch the Great Winter Offensive? Quote, he must have had his doubts, commented Hitler, reflecting on the German victory in East Prussia. He has always been wary of sending his troops into a highly developed area, as they would be bound to realize the absurdity of Bolshevism after seeing it. So it is possible that he'll move them into here, end quote, indicating the Vistula bridgeheads in Poland. Quote, and up there, on the Baltic, he'll say that he's got what he wanted by snapping off this thing, meaning Army Group North, end quote. Some minutes later, after hearing of an aircraft reconnaissance report on the menacing Soviet bridgehead across the Vistula at Baranov, Hitler again postulated, quote, that's where we must be on the lookout. Everything he's doing up here is just a diversion. Besides, he must sense that up here on German soil, i.e. East Prussia, he'll have to shed a lot of blood. A lot. End quote. Hairline cracks were now appearing in the enemy alliance. Stalin had given British and American military delegations 24 hours to get out of Bulgaria. His invasion of Romania and Bulgaria flagrantly violated the Tehran Agreements of 1943, as the Cicero documents showed. Stalin's annexation of eastern Poland was causing uproar in London and Washington. On October 10th, moreover, Himmler had shown Hitler a strong clue that Stalin was again putting out oblique feelers to him. At about this time, Sonnleitner followed Hitler into his bunker bedroom one evening and asked if Ribbentrop might now take up feelers that the masseur of Madame Kollontai, the Soviet ambassador in Stockholm, was putting out. A German-Soviet rapprochement, even at this late date, was Ribbentrop's dream. Hitler warily threw himself onto his bed, dangling his legs over the edge, and argued against giving any sign that could be interpreted as weakness. Sonnleitner used every logical argument at his disposal. Finally, Hitler agreed to the request, but added cynical words that sent a chill down the diplomat's spine. Quote, "If this does lead to peace with the Soviets, we shall have to fight them all over again on some more propitious occasion. Communism is never going to abandon its aim of Bolshevik world domination. Nobody else will be able to fight this battle. I, myself, shall have to win it for the German people." End quote. In Britain, Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden admitted in Parliament that relations with Stalin were strained. Neither Stalin nor Hitler could fail to see that the British were still purposefully allowing the Wehrmacht to escape unhindered from the southern Balkans to the battlefields in Hungary. Quote, "It's obvious the British could have done something here, given the position we're in," Jodl commented to Hitler. "They only had to invade somewhere along here," indicating the Adriatic coast of the Balkans, "and they would have cut us off completely down here. Cut us off completely down there. End quote. In Iran, British and American oil interests had already provoked a government crisis over their dispute with the Russian oil interests. In Greece, the government appointed by the British military commander had disbanded the communist guerrilla units. At the same time, German intelligence had reported Russian tanks appearing on Bulgaria's frontier with Turkey, only 100 miles from the coveted Dardanelles. Hitler speculated, quote, "Perhaps they," that is the British, "have disengaged a tactical wing from the fighting in Italy to be on the safe side. Because for all the polite phrases they are swapping, the tension seems to be building up. Perhaps they are disengaging it to transfer it to Greece or to here." At this point, Hitler's finger must have tapped northern Turkey. It's quite definite that the Russian will attack here. The Russian, referring to Stalin, will attack here. And when you're on one shore of the Dardanelles, you don't just stop there. You can only use the waterway if you control both shores. So he'll have to take the second bit as well, southern Turkey. And that, concluded Hitler logically, will start the whole structure toppling. My view is the British are standing by because vital interests are at stake. End quote. Meanwhile, the OKW instructed German military attachés not to discuss the coming East-East conflict at all. With Hitler's last European ally gone, and the German nation nevertheless unbowed by bombing or military reserves, the Allies could only hope for a speedy victory if the Führer was dead or a power struggle broke out. Rumors abounded in the foreign press that he was ill, exhausted in an asylum, or even Himmler's captive. Quote, "According to this one," Hitler guffawed, reading in one news report aloud to his staff, "I'm a prisoner in my own house, my quote-unquote residence on the Obersalzberg," end quote. Prisoner he already was in one sense at the Wolf's Lair, trapped within his own fragile frame. At night he could only sleep with the help of Phanodorm. Professor Morell, not privy to plans for the coming great offensive, urged him to quote-unquote go away for 8 or 10 days. But Hitler disclosed to him on November 7th that he had first to face up to a number of vital decisions. Shortly after midnight, Hitler suddenly sent for the physician, who noted the next day, quote, "All of a sudden, the Führer was attacked by spasms in the sternum and massive gas buildup in the abdomen. As he told me, he was momentarily about to make the biggest decisions of his life, hence the increasingly violent nervous strains," end quote. Morell injected the morphine-like narcotics Eucodal and Eupivirine intravenously, but the injections only partly blanketed the pain. Quote, "The Führer thanked me profusely for this first aid," end quote. Morell entered pedantically in his diary, and then, quote, "The Führer then told me that I couldn't imagine how deeply the recent doctor's intrigues against me had angered him. Quote, "For those idiots Brandt, Hasselbeck, and Giesing not to have realized the damage they were doing to me, I would have found myself suddenly without a doctor, although these gentlemen must know that you have already saved my life several times in the 8 years that you have been with me. I am not an ungrateful person, my dear doctor. If we both see our way through this war in one piece, then you shall see how generously I shall reward you afterwards," end quote. On the same afternoon, Hitler moved into his new, larger bunker. Its rooms were much more spacious, and it even had large windows looking out over woods and fields. On November 12th, Morell had to abandon him temporarily, pleading a heart complaint, but his assistant, Dr. Richard Weber, proved equally acceptable to Hitler. On some days, Weber found himself called to Hitler's bunker 3 or 4 times. On November 13th, Hitler was examined by the dentist Blaschke and by SS Major Stumpfeger as well. His throat was becoming sore, and he was finding it difficult to eat. He postponed the necessary x-rays, fearing they might reveal a malignancy. The preparations for his top-secret counterattack in the Ardennes were nearing completion. At Arnhem, Aachen, and now Antwerp, a series of costly battles had been inflicted on the Allies. Aachen, the westernmost town of the Reich, had barred the American advance across the West Wall. Hitler had ordered the town defended house by house, just as Stalingrad had been. He repeated his Paris order that on entering the enemy was to find only a field of ruins. When Aachen was overrun on October 21st, the Allies found that Hitler had used the respite to rebuild the West Wall line to the east. Every ton of supplies that the enemy moved to the Aachen area for the later drive to the Ruhr pleased Hitler more, for then the booty from the Ardennes attack would be bigger. He told his staff he would not be tempted to divert reinforcements from his own Ardennes buildup, quote, even if the enemy pushes through to Cologne, end quote. This was General Eisenhower's main objective for early November. But Rundstedt launched a strong spoiling attack on October 27th, and Eisenhower's plans were delayed by 2 weeks. Meanwhile, General Patton, south of the Ardennes, had assured his superiors that he could reach the Saar in 3 days and then, quote, easily breach the West Wall. Patton's attack began on November 8th, but confronted with pouring rain, mud, and minefields, he advanced only 15 miles in 8 days before the elastic tactics of General Hermann Balck, the stubborn defense of the city of Metz, finally halted him. Hitler had not lost his nerve. In his secret order for the Ardennes attack, signed on November 10th, he expressly accepted all the risks, quote, even if the enemy offensive on either side of Metz and the imminent attack on the Ruhr region should create major inroads into our territory or fortifications, end quote. It was a calculated risk, but one largely justified by events. His throat had now been x-rayed, and on the 18th, it was again examined at Karlshof Hospital near Rostenburg by Eichen, Morell, Stumpfeger, and Dr. Brandt. A laryngeal polyp had been found in his left vocal cord. It was not a malignant tumor, but Eichen would have to operate on Hitler's throat in Berlin at once. The Führer's departure from East Prussia was kept secret. At 3:15 p.m. on November 20th, while the noise and clatter of the construction gangs working on the last bunkers still continued, Hitler left the Wolf's Lair for Görlitz Station and boarded his train. An SS orderly listed those at dinner as Bormann, Morell, the dietitian of Fräulein Constanze Marziali, Schaub, the impresario Benno von Arndt, and 2 secretaries. One of the latter wrote evocatively of the journey, quote, I had come to love the forest life and East Prussia's landscape. Now we were leaving them forever. Hitler probably knew that too, although he had ordered the construction work continued as though he intended to return one day. He too was in a farewell mood. Had he not always maintained that so long as he personally commanded any sector, it had never been abandoned. His carriage windows were blacked out. He sat in his compartment with the light switched on, a twilight-like a museum. I had never seen Hitler as dejected and distant as on this day. His voice barely rose above a whisper. His eyes were rooted to a spot on the white tablecloth. An oppressive atmosphere crowded in on the narrow, swaying cage around us. Hitler suddenly began to talk about an operation and about his confidence in Professor von Eichen's skill. Quote, it's a great responsibility for him, but he's the only one who can do it. An operation on the vocal cords isn't dangerous, but it may leave me with no voice, end quote. At 5:30 a.m., the train arrived at Berlin's Grunwald Station. With the car's headlights picking out only ruins to the right and left, Hitler was driven back to his chancellery. His sojourn here lasted 3 weeks. Miss Eva Braun joined him and lunched and dined with him almost every day. Professor von Eichen operated on him on November 22nd. The pathologist confirmed that the polyp was benign, of the kind more commonly referred to as a quote-unquote Singer's knot. The morphine injection Eichen used to The Fuhrer proved an alarming overdose, however, for he was knocked out by it for nearly 8 hours. The professor had failed to take into account Hitler's total abstinence from alcohol and nicotine in calculating the dose. Gradually, Hitler's voice returned, although by early December, he could still only whisper. Soon, the entire chancellery was talking in whispers, too. He remained out of sight, kept company only by Eva and the three older secretaries. An adjutant brought him the war reports. When Albert Speer came for a conference on November 28th, it was obvious Hitler was getting better. Goebbels, too, was inspired by their chief's recovery. After spending hours with him until 5:30 a.m. on the first day of December, listening to his secret plans for the coming Ardennes offensive, he wrote, quote, "When I consider how sickly and weak he was when I saw him bedridden several weeks ago, when he already outlined these same great plans to me, then I can only say that a miracle has come over him," end quote. Hitler told him that if the offensive succeeded, they could, quote-unquote, Dunkirk the British Army for a second time and restart the current stalled V1 bombardment of southern England. 2 days later, Hitler visited the Goebbels family at their lakeside home for the last time. Noticing that Goebbels had brought their priceless paintings out of bunker storage for the occasion, he talked of the devastation and loss of life in Berlin. Then he laughed out loud, referring to the prophecies that the British were uttering about the rapid approach of victory. "Things were looking up," he commented, and Goebbels, aware of the coming Ardennes offensive, noted in his diary, quote, "I, of course, understand precisely what he's getting at," unquote. At 5 p.m. on December 10th, Hitler left Berlin, bound for the Western Front. He noticed that his urine was as brown as beer, so there were still traces of jaundice left. He sent for Morel at 7 p.m. because of a few residual stomach cramps. The physician gave him a spasmopurin suppository. In darkness, 8 hours later, Hitler left his train and was driven by car onto the Eagle's Nest, the bunker headquarters built in 1940 at Bad Nauheim near the Western Front. They were 800 feet above sea level here, as Morel was pleased to note, quote, "like lints," unquote. He observed that Hitler's skin was still yellowish in hue. Quote, "At 5:40 p.m., Führer had a conference lasting several hours around 40 or 50 generals. They say he was very alert and lively, inspiring and compelling," end quote. Hitler was tired but contented. The British and Americans had still not detected what he was up to. His voice was still not strong enough to command a larger audience than these generals on the 12th, but these were the generals whose divisions would launch the great attack on the 16th. A shorthand record exists of his speech. He suggested that evil forces had blocked Germany's unification ever since the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648. People suffered the hardships of war bravely, but only so long as victory was still possible. If that hope was now suddenly removed from the enemy, their people must turn against the war. Quote, "Whatever they do, they cannot expect me to surrender. Never, never," end quote. Frederick the Great had fought on in the Seven Years' War, although his generals and even his own brother had lost hope. Quote, "His state presidents, his ministers, turned up from Berlin in droves to beg him to stop the war because it could no longer be won. But the tenacity of that one man made it possible to fight on until finally the tide miraculously turned. To suggest that if the throne hadn't changed hands in Russia, the tide would not have changed is quite beside the point, because if they had stopped the war in the fifth year, a throne change in the seventh year would have been neither here nor there. That is the moment we have to wait for." End quote. Never in history, he said, had heterogeneous coalitions such as existed between East and West in 1944 survived for long. The enemy powers were already at each other's throats. Quote, "If you sit at the center of the web like a spider and follow this trend, you can see how from hour to hour the contrasts between them grow. If we throw in a few really powerful punches, we may at any moment see this entire artificially erected common front suddenly collapse with a mighty clap of thunder." End quote. The Ardennes offensive began at 5:30 a.m. on December 16, 1944. The weather was perfect for the attack. That's the end of the chapter and the end of part 7.